Today's operation is the frustration of Vietnam in miniature.
I shall not see.
The worst area we've been in since I've been in Vietnam. Awful sick, and I'll be so glad to go home.
And I will not accept.
As men clamored over one another, pushing aside women and children in their panic-stricken fury, members of the air crew dragged them onto the plane, trying to fill it as fast as possible.
The nomination of my party for another term as your president.
For it seems now more certain than ever that the bloody experience of Vietnam is to end in a stalemate.
This is Dr. Stephen Nurse. These episodes of Is Abled focus on the brave men and women who fought in the Vietnam War, not the politics that surrounded the war. This is The War in Vietnam, Part 2. Those who were there are still fighting because the jungle changes a man. Hello, this is Dr. Steve Nurse, and this is our second series that we're doing on Vietnam. We had a lot of positive reaction to it the first time, and people really enjoyed, I don't know if enjoyed is the right word, but found it very informative to listen to the actual stories of vets. And especially now when people that age and my age, I'm 73, and that's probably of the folks that went into Vietnam a pretty average age. So today we are going to interview, as I told him earlier, he lists himself young when he was younger as little Billy Fields, but now he's older and wiser Bill Fields. So I think that's what we'll call him. We'll call him the older and wiser version. And Bill, tell me a little bit about your life right now, kind of where you are right now, and what you're doing.
Well, I'm retired. I'm 100% disabled through the VA because of Agent Orange. I currently live in Southport, North Carolina, which was established somewhere around 1788 or something like that. And it's right at the three junctions of the Intercoastal Waterway, the Cape Fear River, and the Atlantic Ocean. And I've been married for 34 years. I have one daughter, 30, and she lives in Richmond, Virginia. And currently, with the exception of some Agent Orange problems that the VA takes care of, I've got a pretty decent life, pretty wonderful life.
That's great. What did you do for an occupation after you got out of the service?
Well, I went to work in construction. My dad was in construction, and he was a superintendent for Thacker Construction at the time, and he built commercial buildings such as schools and colleges and shopping centers and whatnot. So, I mean, Charlottesville has a lot of his buildings that he put up, along with Williamsburg and...
Great. What was I going to say? And so many also of the vets that I've talked to have had trouble with Agent Orange. We're just talking to a gentleman who's also 100% disabled. He has, they say, about 98% of the people, 95% of the males now that came out of Vietnam have prostate cancer. The other things are lymphoma and other kinds of issues like that. So do you mind telling me how has it affected you?
Well, I'm listed as being service-connected for a heart condition. Uh-huh. I've got neuropathy of the feet, hearing loss. I've got diabetes.
And a lot of
type 2.
I was going to say, and I was going to say a lot of, that's another thing. You didn't see very, now when I see people in Washington here working on the ferry boats and working on construction sites, everybody's got those, you know, noise canceling headphones, and the pictures you see in Vietnam of, you know, it's put your hands over your ears, and that's the kind of way it works. One of the questions that that I and you answered it here, but let's talk about it a little bit. I've asked everybody that I've interviewed what was their first impression when they hit the ground in Vietnam. So, what was your first impression when that when you did
that? What happened with us? You know, a lot of people went over on ships. I was one of the fortunate ones that went over on aircraft. I went on Flying Tiger Airways, and after a brief stop in Anchorage and then to Okinawa, we flew to Vietnam. It was night when I got there, and the first landing site we were supposed to go to was under attack. So they diverted us to Bien Hoa, I think is the way they pronounce it.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened was, you know, when we landed there, the red flares was going up, the white flares were going up. You could see impact flashes. And that was my introduction to Vietnam. The plane came to a halt at the runway. They opened the doors and said, "Get the hell off the plane." And that was that. That's the way I remember Vietnam. And it was extremely hot, and the smell—I'll never forget that smell. It's just something every GI remembers. It was scary, and I was scared. Here we had like 150 GIs or more. We didn't have any weapons. We didn't have any equipment, and we're all running around pitch black. Because it's a blackout, except for the flares, and we don't know where the hell to go.
Wow! And
that was my introduction to Vietnam, and I was almost—I kept remembering that I thought I was going to die that night.
Wow! And I think that one of the things that our engineer here, Rick, and I have heard in all these interviews is virtually that it was hot, it was humid, it was dusty, and comments like you could taste the air, you know, you could chew the air. And we've also had at least two other people that we've interviewed. One of my friends from my high school who said, you know, when the plane landed, the pilot said, "Get out of here and start running." And my friend said, "Where should we run to?" And the guy said, "In front of him, just follow me." And didn't have a dang idea where they were going, one way or the other. But that's got to be a pretty scary introduction when you know, in that kind of a blackout, and then with the smell of garbage and the smell of diesel and everything else. When you said you saw impact, what was the term you used? You saw
impact flashes.
Does that mean it hit something? Or
yes, well, the rounds hit the ground and you get a flash, and you know, in the daylight you can see the smoke and the results of the flash. In at night it's just flash,
uh-huh.
And it was scary. I mean, you gotta think. Here we are, you know, at 19, 20 years old. We just got out of high school. You know, we were still thinking about cars and girls. And here you go a year later, you in Vietnam trying to stay alive.
Yeah, yeah. And what a, I mean, you know, and you were like where you were from. I mean, you were in Fort Bragg for your basic training. And then all of a sudden you wind up in Vietnam in a totally different environment, totally different everything. So once you once you got there, that you talk about this My Tho orphanage?
My Tho.
My Tho, yeah. And
well,
tell me what your involvement there.
Well, I don't know how I exactly, because other guys in the unit had been there longer than I had. They had begun, by the way, I was with the 9th Infantry Division down in the Delta at a place called Dongtam, and that was right on the Mito River. And we, other people had been there, and they had got used to going and volunteering at the orphanage, and it's something that I always enjoyed kids and trying to help out. So I got involved with going on Sundays when we were in base camp and not in the field, because I was about 10 months in the field while I was in Vietnam. But at base camp, we were basically responsible for keeping up our, vehicles, radio equipment, and that kind of stuff. So Sundays, the guys would get together and they would get a chaplain or anybody that wanted to volunteer. We would go to the Mito orphanage and repair the damage done by the VC, because they constantly hit the orphanage. And we would actually do whatever the nuns ask us to do. And I think I sent you a picture of me with two of the nuns. And if yes. I didn't, I meant to.
I did not. Yeah, maybe send that, anything like that, send that to me again, because
okay.
I'd like to use those. But the Americans were viewed as such bad guys. And, of course, in war, bad things happen. I think sometimes we negate the positive things that...
It's like that photograph that became so famous of that little girl with no clothes on running down the highway, and they blamed the Americans for that. That was not us. That was South Vietnam Air Force. But I got to the point where on Sundays when I was in base camp, and, I happened to be at base camp at Dong Tam, every Sunday we would get up. We would fill a deuce and halves full of sea rations or anything that the cooks wanted to give us. We would get some nurses or some medical supplies together, building supplies. If we had lumber left over or if we had paint or anything like that, we would load it up and convoy to Mito, because that's what we did. We did not like the single trucks going in and coming back in the dark, because they had a habit of mining roads and waiting for us. But we would go down there, and whatever the nuns wanted, whatever they needed, we volunteered to do. So we would spend the morning and into the afternoon basically just doing whatever the nuns wanted us to do in regards to repairs and remodeling and whatever. And then in the afternoon, we would spend time with the kids, and I really enjoyed that. And I carried a camera with me most of the time when I was not in the field. And I've got some great photos of the orphanage and the kids, the nuns, and some of the people that lived there. And we really enjoyed that. And it was something that we needed and the kids needed. They couldn't speak our language. I couldn't speak theirs.
But they needed the positive.
They knew we cared, and we would hold their hand. And before we went, packages we would get in the mail, we would go through them, and anything like chewing gum, hard candy, anything that we could get and stuff our pockets full, we would do so. By the way, speaking of which, I wrote a little short story, and my sister-in-law, Shirley Ralston, asked me if she could put that on her. It was a church blog she had, and it's on the Internet. If you type in Sergeant William Fields and then fill my pockets full, I've got a little story that she published that... explains what we did. We needed them, because it was like being home, having
Yeah.
The kids just as much as they needed us.
That's interesting. And why was it the Viet Cong that were hitting the orphanage or were?
Yeah. Yes.
And why were they doing that?
Well, a lot of times at the orphanage they hit Amerasian kids because they were part Vietnamese,
okay,
and part American.
Mm-hmm.
And they would do anything they could, you know, to disrupt.
Sure, sure. Yeah, it is really interesting. And if we'll connect to by email again, and I'll make sure you get a copy of the interview, and maybe you can send me the link then to that, since I'm on the air now, since you can send the link to that,
okay,
that story. We'd like to. We could put that maybe on our webpage here.
Okay.
And
awesome.
And so were you in combat then too? Wouldn't you say?
Well, it depends on what you call combat. I was not attached. I was attached to the 9th Infantry Division, and there was no place in Vietnam that wasn't in combat.
Yeah,
and there was no place in Vietnam that, you know, somebody didn't pick up a rifle and defend themselves or be called to assist in defending wherever they were. I had an MOS of 31 mic, which was a radio relay carrier operator. And what we did, we had a 2.5-ton truck, which we called a deuce and a half, that had all our equipment. We would go out into the field with a brigade, such as the 3rd Brigade is what I was in support of mostly in a Delta. And we would set up a 45-foot antenna and a 25-foot backup. And we were the relay part of our MOS, radio relay carrier.
Mm-hmm.
We were between point A and point B. Point B being where the infantry was in contact, and point A being the base camp or whoever was giving the orders. And we were in the field in between. Most of the time, we were in a area that was supported by an artillery unit or armored PCs. And what we would do, I called ourselves the infantry's lifeline. We were the ones that were, you know, they called us when they needed help. If they were in deep crap, be polite. You know, if
that
they,
was very polite of you, too, Bill.
If they were in deep crap, then what happens was they would radio, and we would get their calls because base camp or whoever was too far out. It was us that rerouted their calls to whoever else would give them support, be it naval, air, artillery, or just plain another infantry unit that may be in the area. So that was my job, and we did it pretty damn well. We took pride. I didn't particularly want to go to Vietnam. I got drafted, and I ended up signing up for an extra year after I got the basic. But the thing of it was, once you get in there, you know, you do your job the best you can. My dad was in World War II. He was wounded twice in action and captured once. A lot of people were going to Canada when I got drafted.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't think about that because I knew my dad, who I loved. There was no way I could have looked that man in the eye and not done my duty because he did his.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it was just one of those things that you had to do it, so you go over and do it to the best of your ability.
Mm-hmm. Well, we also have interviewed some folks that were, you know, conscientious objectors, but served as medics, and you know, chose to do that. And to me, that's, you know, honorable too. And you know, you do your like you do your duty, and that's the way it is. What are the things about Vietnam that you'll never, what are the images or what are the things about Vietnam that you never forget, that are in your mind all the time?
Well, one of the main images that I still have dreams about, and I also have post-traumatic stress, one of my first trips into the field, I believe it was to a place called Firebase Moore.
Mm-hmm.
We set up, and we were there, and a decent half is high, and it has a set of steps that goes down to the ground so that you can get up and down easy.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened was we had set up, and this 3.5-ton truck pulled up, and they unloaded the bodies of 5 LRPs. Now, they were called LRPs, but they were long-range recon patrol. They were in camouflage uniforms, and they had been killed in the jungles. They brought these 5 bodies out, and they laid them on the ground right there next to our van. And they had been in the jungle for a while, and the heat had made their bodies swell so much that they had actually split the seams on their pants.
Wow.
And two were black, and 3 were white, and they were so discolored that you couldn't tell hardly which was which.
Wow.
And I just remember seeing them and thinking, my God, I don't want to end up like that.
Yeah. And also, I think you have to consider, I mean, the first friend that I had that I ever saw who was dead was my final year in high school. It was a kid named Dan Runyon, and he was killed on a motorcycle. And I had never, you know, other than a grandpa or a grandma or something that you heard that died in Iowa, never really was experienced to that. And I can't, you know, I think we don't realize, you said, you know, PTSD. We don't realize the impact of a young kid like you or the other millions that were over there that saw images like that, that, you know, no one expects to see. You know, I can't imagine.
Well,
go ahead.
That is one of the things that, I had a real hard time with my mother when I got back. My dad, I think, understood more because he was in combat in World War II. But my mother couldn't understand why the same sweet little Billy Fields didn't come home. And I had changed so much, you know. I mean, I was jumping every time a door slammed because it sounded like a mortar.
Wow.
And, I mean, it was just one of those things that I did not want. I didn't want to talk about Vietnam. I didn't want to hear about Vietnam. I doggone sure didn't want somebody trying to tell me what to do because I had done that for 3 years.
Yeah.
And she really had a hard time, and I had a hard time with it, dealing with her.
Mm-hmm. She expected you to be somebody different, I suppose, is kind of
what
I hear you're saying, you know. Your father, who had been in combat, had, you know, probably knew, you know, we talking about PTSD, but World War II, people went through the same kinds of things, you know, similar,
called it shell shock.
Shell shock, that's right. They called it shell shock and, you know, different names for it when we were in Korea, we finally got I've had friends that came back that were just really, really very different and very changed. And how could that not change you? How about, and you mentioned that in here that you kind of self-medicated probably with drink and some other things too, right?
I did. When I got back, I had, you know, I had to stay, I wrapped myself in work. You know, I'm a hard worker. I wanted to work all the time. I wanted to work as much overtime as I could. And when I did not do that, I got involved with softball, and I played softball all I could. I played in a couple of leagues. We signed up for every tournament that we could play out of town. So So every weekend we were playing softball in places like Norfolk or Richmond or someplace like that. And when I wasn't doing that, and of course when you were involved with softball and that kind of stuff, you start drinking.
Yeah.
And I did. I drank to forget, you know, and it was just something that I still do, but not nearly as much as I did. And
yeah.
It was something that it was just my way of dealing with it. And I, of course, back then they had not really reached out and told us about the VA and things that we could get help on. And it wasn't until about 4 or 5 years ago that I got a lady I bumped into down at the employment agency, saw my hat, and she said, are you in the VA? And I said, no, ma'am. She pointed a finger at me, and she shook it, and she said, I want to see you in my office as soon as you come out of there. I said, yes, ma'am. She says, I'm right down on the hall on the left. I said, yes, ma'am. So I went over. I saw her. Her name was Paula. And bless her heart, she got me into the VA, and she told me what papers to file. And, of course, they give you all the tests and stuff, and it determines what your percentage is. And it took a while, but they finally diagnosed me with 100%.
Wow. I think that's happened here, too. And I live on a little island. It's called Vashon Island, where we have a radio station. We're about 8 miles swimming from Seattle, and sometimes the ferries don't run it, so you just have to swim the 8 miles. But we have a very strong Veterans Administration organization out here, and I think that's really, really helped a lot of people in it. And again, you were exposed probably to Agent Orange, and
yes.
That probably has caused a lot of these issues. Is that fair to say?
Yeah.
Yeah. But overall, I think were they really negative towards you when you got home?
Other than my family, I'd say 90% were. They ignored you, or if they saw you in a uniform or anything like that, you know, they would actually cross the street to keep from walking by you. I mean, things were different back then, and I could understand with the protests. And you got to remember, you know, there was like Martin Luther King, and both of the Kennedys got killed, you know, assassinated,
right.
You know, and it, all of the stuff going on with that college that they killed the students, you know, it was just one of those things that everybody
yeah.
was upset with the war, but they took it out on the veterans, and that was not right.
Yeah.
We were the first and only generation that had ever fought for our country, regardless of whether we wanted to go.
Yeah.
That
and
wasn't
I think it was
treated well.
Well, and I think too that yeah, I think that's true, and people came from all over the place, and I think that, you know, the one thing that I heard that I really appreciate is you saying that, you know, overall you're pretty satisfied with your life, and
I am.
So you're about, what, I'm 73, so you must be about 73, too.
No, I'm 75.
Oh, okay. Well, I'll refer to you as, okay, so my interviewee, Bill Fields, who is my senior by 2 years, I'm glad things are, you know, that you do consider you've had a good life. And
Well, Paula, who got me into the VA, I thank her because, you know, when I got into the VA, I was able to get some help. I went to several classes about post-traumatic stress.
Mm-hmm.
But I only did that, I think, for 16 sessions or so, because most of the people that were in there were from Iraq and Afghanistan, and there was a large age difference.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was hard for me, you know, they couldn't understand what we went through, and we, you know, we had an idea of what they went through, but it really would have been better if they had just
broken it down a little bit. But yeah. Yeah. Well, I really, I will make sure that we connect, and you, if you'd send me some more of those pictures, and
I can send you as many as you want.
Well, send me a bunch, okay. Also, I want to let you know that I will, when we do the airing of these programs, we will get a copy to you, and I really appreciate you taking your time to interview with me. And you take care and have a wonderful 75-degree day.
And I want to thank also you and your people, but I also want to thank Chris Gaynor.
Okay.
Chris, I think you interviewed him, if I'm
right.
Not mistaken.
Right.
And Chris and I have been friends for many years now, and I only met him one time. And he is a heck of a guy, and
he sure is.
And you know, he's on Vashon Island,
right? Right.
And I feel fortunate to be his friend.
Okay. Well, I'll let him know.
Okay.
Okay, Bill. You take care, and we'll talk to you again.
Can I say one other thing?
One other thing. Yes, you sure can.
Okay. Okay. Now, when I got back about several years ago, I visited a place called the Vietnam War Foundation, and anybody could probably read up. I sent you brochures on it.
Yes.
We actually closed it 2 years ago when the curator died. His name was Craig LaMontagne. He was recognized by Congress and from the one of the congressmen out there in your way, I'm not sure whether it was Oregon or Washington. But anyway, we became the largest hands-on museum in the nation as far as Vietnam equipment. And that set us apart from any other museum because we were able to let people get into the Hueys, get into the fixed wing, get into the APCs, get into the trucks, the deuce and halves, the three quarters, you know, and it was well done. And it's a shame that it closed, but it's going to reopen in Nelson County in the coming future because things were delayed because of COVID. But, you know, people might be able to see something about the Vietnam War Foundation.
I think that's something that I'd sure like to see. And, we'll make sure that gets out in some of our publicity here, and that'd be great. And I'll give Chris the word for you, and
awesome.
And he's doing well. And again, thank you.
Okay.
And it's Mr. Bill Fields, or better known as Little Billy Fields. So
there you go.
Okay, we'll talk to you later. Goodbye.
Okay.
But it is increasingly clear to this report that the only rational way out then will be to negotiate, not as victors, but as an honorable people who lived up to their pledge to defend democracy and did the best they could.
April 30th, 1975 was the official end of the war in Vietnam. But to say it was the end of the war would not be giving all those who participated their earned respect. The collateral damage continues and causes suffering to this day. Dr. Steve Nurse, signing off.